The third case for oral argument this morning is the State of South Dakota versus Rex Gard, Mr. Gard being the appellant. For Mr. Gard, we have Mr. Thomas Adams, an attorney from Deadwood, and for the appellee, State of South Dakota, we have Mr. Frank Geegan, an assistant attorney general from Pierre. Mr. Adams, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
May it please the court and counsel. My client in this case, Rex Gard, was a contractor from Gillette who met Barry Smith, who lived here in Spearfish. They formed a friendship. Ultimately, he came to Spearfish and worked for him. From that work, discussion was done with Mr. Smith, as well as another doctor here in Spearfish, Dr. Little, and they agreed to form a company, the purpose of which was to build and sell townhouses to make a profit. Originally, the company was going to be Smith and Little, or S&L. The parties, through discussion, ultimately decided to form an LLC, which incorporated all three of these individuals. It's important that, I guess, to see that none of the parties actually really invested anything into this arrangement, if you will. Very little money was put in, and that was taken out very early by the doctors. They formed the LLC and sent their documents into the state of South Dakota. Other than that, they did very little as far as actually running the business enterprise the way you would run a business enterprise. They never signed their operating agreement. They had a contract to initially build houses. It was signed only, I guess, by my client some long time after the venture was underway. Lots that they built on were never transferred to the LLC. They always remained in the names of the doctors.
What about the checkbook? What about the checkbook? What about the checkbook? I don't remember reading anything about that. Was that an LLC checkbook? Or was it in the name of...
The LLC was Dakota Properties. That was their ultimate business. My client's business was called Planet Builders. Dakota Properties, which was the LLC building the properties, that checkbook was always held by Dr. Little.
Yeah, but what was the account name?
What was the account in?
Was the account the LLC or Dr. Smith?
Yes, it was. It was in the name of Dakota Properties, the LLC.
So the money that came in and the money that went out was written on LLC checks.
Correct. My client, as the person doing the work, I just want to back up a minute, because the way they funded this and where the money came from was from a bank loan. The bank loan was obtained, and the parties had an appointment to apply for this loan. At the last minute, they didn't know how much money they needed, so they came to my client the night before. They needed a bid, something to show the bank as to how much money they needed to build these houses. He put something together. That's what they stuck with throughout the project. Later, it turned out that he had forgotten a lot of things. But the money was then placed in the account of Dakota Properties. That money was paid to Planet Builders, my client's LLC, to then do the work on the building. The doctors were members of the LLC, but had nothing to do with the day-to-day operations. At one point in the state's brief, they referred to Dr. Smith becoming sick and Dr. Little taking over his responsibility. That wasn't the case. It's clear that my client was the builder. He was the one day-to-day working on this contract. He didn't have another job. The doctors both were employed, had other things that occupied their time. So he was the only one day-to-day working on the business. When he needed to have money to pay bills, to pay employees, he would then have to go to Dr. Little and present him with an invoice. And he did that, and then he would get paid. At some point in time, then the loan that they had got was becoming exhausted. They didn't have enough money. The house wasn't finished. About that time, Dr. Little discovered there's other bills that are unpaid, and the business relationship broke down. And there's dispute as to whether or not the doctors told my client to quit working or whether he got angry and quit. But at some point in time, the relationship, as far as his building the properties, ended, and that was done. It's also important to back up to know that when they started this enterprise, it was necessary to have credit because they didn't always, they couldn't go to the store, if you will, and pay cash for the supplies they needed. They needed to have credit, and they needed to have credit early on. They needed credit from concrete suppliers right up front. They needed credit from businesses or organizations that would provide them with the tools they needed to build the structure. These were all put in place early on. The doctor's testimony was that early on in the relationship, which only lasted about 9 months, early on in the relationship, the doctors went with my client to establish these credit accounts. They knew that he personally had no credit. He had just recently did a bankruptcy, could not get credit. It had to be done through Dakota Properties. His background was such that no one would give him credit based upon just his status, and it was necessary for the doctors to provide their wherewithal, if you will, to allow them to obtain that credit. This was done not only at suppliers that supplied them with the materials they needed to build it. There was one very specific instance I'm going to talk about later with Connects, where credit was needed. My client went and signed the credit application. Since it didn't do any good to sign his name, he signed the credit application with Dr. Smith's name. There was a confrontation, if you will, when Dr. Smith met with him at the Connects building, and they talked about the fact that he had signed Dr. Smith's name, which he readily admitted that he had signed his name because Dr. Smith was out of town. There were words between Dr. Smith and my client, but he wasn't to do that. But then immediately the credit application was ratified, and they used that credit account for the remainder of the project. This happened early on. There was miscommunications, and it's probably true in every construction contract of that type.
You're talking a lot about the facts. I'm assuming the jury heard these facts.
That's correct.
So, what does that, how do these facts that you're discussing relate to what we are here to decide as a matter of law?
The facts are important to several of the issues that we've got here. I'm going to, if I may, though, just start with the very first one. It's been the law in South Dakota for 100 years or so that a person cannot steal from his own business. Reddick established that. It's never been overturned. In Reddick, the court talked about a Nebraska case, Cusick, which related that to corporations because Reddick dealt with a partnership.
Now, did you raise this to the trial court judge?
Not specifically.
So, like when you settled the jury instructions, was that part of an instruction to a jury? or was that a motion that you made to the court?
That was not. That would fall into the required proof of the crime, if you will.
So is that preserved for us to make that decision?
Yes. That is for you to make that decision.
I know, but did you preserve it? Did you raise that at the trial court level?
The motion at the end of the testimony, I think, would have preserved that.
Not this specific issue, though.
I'm sorry?
You didn't present this very precise issue to the trial court.
That precise issue was not presented specifically to the trial court. No.
So you agree, if we're even going to review this, we should only review it under plain error analysis?
Yes.
You never raised the question of the Reddick case with the trial court. Never mentioned it.
No. I don't believe you'll find that anywhere.
You know, in the late 70s, South Dakota completely rewrote the criminal code and adopted most of the model penal code. Hasn't that, in effect, overruled the Reddick case, the new definitions, and the...
I don't believe so.
Why not?
Well, it's never been specifically addressed, and I don't think there's anything that specifically addresses that issue as far as the readoption.
Reddick was a 19th century case, and there's been a lot of decisions around the country since then, and there's no other decision that you've cited to us from any state that says that a person can steal from their partners, and that's not a crime, is there? This is the only case you can find, and it's a case from the 1800s.
There's been no South Dakota case that addresses that issue at all. But it's been the holding for 100 years, and I would suggest that it's still the holding of this court.
So there's no such crime as embezzlement as long as you're one of the owners of the corporation or shareholder?
Well, I think Cusick, which was discussed in Reddick, addresses that issue. And it's only, Reddick only applies to the situation where your involvement with the company is not just as a clerk in a menial manner. So Mr. Gard's involvement was as one of the three major owners. Well, there's only three. He was a 30% owner. So it's not just as a clerk who has money come into his hands as a function of what he's doing in a day-to-day job, but it's as an owner of the company.
I believe the question referenced him as being a shareholder, so I'll ask it again. Is he immune from any charges of embezzlement because he is a shareholder under your argument? He can just clean out the treasury of the corporation.
Yeah, I think that's authorized. This is a member-managed LLC. Each member has an opportunity or has the right to manage the business of the company.
That would sure come as a surprise to the Enron defendants because, you know, that law certainly didn't apply in that case where they're stealing from their own company. But you're saying South Dakota is the only state that allows this kind of fraud to go on? Partners can rob each other and there's no crime?
No, I'm saying that in this particular case, he's involved with company business. He wasn't taking the money out and putting it in his own pocket. He was getting credit, doing business for the purpose of the company.
Well, now, but the jury didn't decide. It wasn't the jury called upon to decide that maybe he was not using this money for company business. He was using it for personal effects. Isn't that right?
I don't think that was ever a jury question.
So your evidence showed that all these charges he took and all the property he took all went right back into the partnership business. None of it went for anything personal.
I think the money was paid from Dakota Properties to Planet Builders. From Planet Builders, yes, he paid himself as well as paying the other bills of the company as he could. So some limited amount of money went to him.
I guess from reading the briefs, I got the impression that some of these charges couldn't be accounted to anything on a project, that they just went into something nobody knows where it went. Wasn't that what the state's evidence was?
I don't think that's accurate at all. I think all of the businesses that there were accounts set up for, all of those were businesses that were supplying materials or supplies for the building project.
So the jury found him guilty of theft for taking property and putting it into the project of these three partners?
Yes, outside of what was allowed under his billings. That some of his billings, for example, he needed cash money to checks to pay bills. So he would give an invoice to Dakota Properties, which included things that did not get paid. And I think that's what was presented to the jury.
Was there any evidence that there was a substantial amount of money or value missing that couldn't be accounted for?
I don't believe there is. You know, it was one of the exhibits with the court was his checking account from Planet Builders, which showed payments to these different suppliers and payments to employees, and there were some payments in there to him and to his wife. But as far as what is substantial, I don't believe that would be accurate, no.
So you're arguing really this should be just a civil lawsuit between the two doctors and Mr. Gard over whether or not there should be a proper accounting civilly rather than criminally?
Correct.
Did you argue that to the jury?
I don't know if I argued that specifically in that language. But
well, I don't mean
certainly
using the same words, but I mean you argued to the jury and they convicted him of theft, didn't they?
That's correct.
Has there been any determination as to what amount is short in these projects? Has there been a civil lawsuit from Smith and Little to recover money that they claim Mr. Gard took?
Yes, and I'm not a party to that, but there was a civil lawsuit. It was defaulted. I believe there's some problems with why it got defaulted, but
you mean by defaulted, you mean he didn't answer and then they took a judgment against him?
Correct.
You know the amount of money involved there?
I don't. It was substantial. It was, I hate to give you that answer because I just don't know that.
Okay.
I believe it to be more than what was included in the restitution amounts in the judgment of the court.
And the restitution amount was what?
Well, it was $60,000 to each of the doctors, and several of the suppliers, so it probably amounts to $150,000.
Okay, thank you.
And has there been a real accounting, though, to go back to your original question?
2 minutes, sir.
No. I don't believe there has, and I don't believe all of the finances from Dakota Properties has been turned over to Mr. Gard so that he could determine that.
Now, your argument number 5 is that he got a 65-year sentence, 65 years in prison, and that this is an effectively a life sentence.
That's
Give
correct.
Us your argument on that.
I think that this court in Bonner set forth the rule that a sentence that disproportionately, excessively disproportionate, is to be determined. Once it's determined that it is, that exceeds the punishment for this type of a crime. In this particular case, Mr. Gard was sentenced to the maximum term on every count that he was convicted on. And the forgeries, which were stacked up, there was five forgeries that he received. He received 50 years on those forgery counts. Those particular offenses, as classified by our legislature, class five felonies, very low on the scale. They were enhanced to class fours because he had a prior felony. But all of those were then stacked consecutively for the crime of forgery and for what's a property crime. No one knows exactly what the amount was. Considerable if you look at, I guess, average income, but not really even that great of an amount, even if it was the $150,000.
Your time has expired, counsel. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Gagan, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Please, court, counsel. As you heard from Mr. Adams, the present appeal stems from a number of theft charges which were filed against his client as a result of a series of incidents taking place in Lawrence County back in 2004. A review of the record reveals that one of the victims in this case, a Dr. Barry Smith, first became acquainted with the defendant in October 2002 when he, Dr. Smith, was visiting his son in Wyoming. The record reflects that Dr. Smith at the time was in the process of building a house for himself and his wife, and a defendant, a general contractor in Wyoming, offered to build it for him. The defendant thereafter elected to move his entire crew, including wives and girlfriends, to South Dakota in order to work on the house. The defendant later complained to Dr. Smith that they needed to find more work for them to do, since it would have been a huge mistake for him to have moved to South Dakota just for one project. It was then that the defendant came up with the idea of building townhouses and later selling it for profit. Smith, along with a fellow co-worker, Dr. Richard Little, thereafter brought two parcels of land in the Spearfish area and formed S&L, Smith and Little Enterprises. They had initially intended it to be a limited liability corporation, with just the two of them being the only shareholders, but the defendant was unhappy and complained that he wanted in as a shareholder because he was doing the actual building and hence, according to the defendant, all the work. The defendant told Drs. Little and Smith that by allowing him in to the corporation as a shareholder, they could keep costs down. He would be on the job site, able to manage overhead, and hence there'd be more profit for them to share when the property was eventually sold. It was for that reason that the Court of Properties was thereafter incorporated, with Drs. Little and Smith each holding a 35% ownership or share in the company. The remaining 30% interest was given to the defendant. It was understood that the Court of Properties would then retain the services of the defendant's company, Planet Builders, in order to do the actual building of the townhouses. Under the terms of the operating agreement reached by the parties, it was understood that the defendant would submit invoices to the company and to the corporation, and that Dr. Little, as secretary of the Court of Properties, would then issue him checks for the amounts listed in those invoices. Now, unfortunately for Dr. Smith, he was later diagnosed with a terminal illness in 2004, and therefore pretty much lost all interest in the real estate venture. Much of the day-to-day operations of the company, specifically from a financial standpoint, was therefore left up to Dr. Little. Problems with the company began to surface in July of 2004 when Dr. Little went to the post office and discovered a stack of unpaid bills that had been referred to collection agencies for payment. Dr. Little contacted Smith and told him that he was positive that the defendant had been stealing from the company. Drs. Smith and Little thereafter made repeated attempts to confront the defendant, asking to see his checkbook, the books, things like that.
When you say his checkbook, you mean the corporation's checkbook or his personal checkbook?
His personal checkbook that he was writing checks on Planet Builders. Although the defendant promised on numerous occasions to meet with the doctors, to show them the checkbooks, and an attempt to determine where the money went, Dr. Smith testified things never quite materialized. Instead, the defendant later told Dr. Smith and Little that he could no longer work with the two of them because they were too stupid. According to the defendant, there was no way he was going to show them his personal checkbook, and therefore there was no proof as to where the money had gone. The defendant later went to the job site and told his work crew that they were no longer working on the townhouse project. That then leads me to the first issue the state would like to address on appeal, that being whether the trial court erred or abused its discretion in not dismissing the theft charges against the defendant on the grounds that as a shareholder and part owner in the Dakota Properties, he allegedly was unable as a matter of law to steal from the company. Now, the state would submit at the outset that the defendant had failed to properly preserve this issue for appeal. A review of the record will show that the motion to dismiss filed by the defendant was limited to the charges contained in count 10 of the indictment. The defendant alleged in his motion that those charges should be dismissed because he had previously pled guilty to failure to file a tax return and failure to pay the State Department of Revenue. At no time was the trial court given the opportunity to consider, let alone decide, the issue not being raised by the defendant on appeal. This court has repeatedly said it will not consider for the first time on appeal issues not raised at the trial court level. It is well established that the trial court must be given an opportunity to correct any alleged errors. Here, how can it be said that the trial court erred and abused its discretion not dismissing the theft charges when it was never asked to do so by the defendant? Even if this court were to consider the issue under the plain error doctrine, the state would submit that the defendant's argument is without any merit. If you look at the defendant's brief, you will see that it's premised entirely on this court's decision in State v. Reddick, which was decided back in 1891, some 110 years ago. As indicated in the state's brief, the rule announced in Reddick has been subject to much criticism. More importantly, given the vast changes that have taken place in the intervening 110 years, the state would submit that Reddick is simply no longer the applicable law. Courts have now uniformly rejected the notion that a partner cannot embezzle from the partnership. Those courts have relied on the definition of property of another, which is found in the Model Penal Code. As defined therein, property of another includes property in which any person other than the actor has an interest upon which the actor is not privileged to infringe, regardless of the fact that the actor also has an interest in that property. That definition was adopted by South Dakota back in 1976, SDCL 22-1-2, subsection 36. And it's been said that the purpose of this definition was to dispel the notion that each of the joint owners of a partnership had complete ownership of the partnership and henceforth any property belonging thereto. The defense argument overlooks the fact that since Reddick was decided back in the 1890s...
You say it's been said. Where has that been said? How do you know that was the intent of the legislature when they adopted it here in South Dakota?
The case is cited to, in a brief, citing to the definition of the Model Penal Code, which is adopted by a substantial majority of the courts, said that the obvious reason behind adopting this particular definition was to do away with the spell, the notion, dating back to the 1890s.
Was there any language changed in that when this state legislature passed it?
I don't believe so, in 1976. Moreover, as I was indicating, since 1890s, the state has now adopted a uniform partnership law, effective in 2001. Uniform partnership law undertakes to outline or define the nature of a partner's interest in partnership property. The defendant's argument specifically overlooks or ignores the provisions of state statute 48-78-203, which now expressly states that property acquired by the partnership is property of the partnership and not of the partners individually. The trend, therefore, has been away from recognizing the partnership as a mere collection of individuals and toward recognizing it as a separate legal entity. Finally, unlike Reddick, Dakota Properties in this case was a limited liability corporation and not a partnership. It was therefore a legal entity separate and distinct from its members and shareholders. Once again, statute specifically provides a limited liability company is a legal entity distinct from its members. Now, the defendant contends on appeal that Dakota Properties never attained the status of anything other than a general partnership because the operating agreement was never specifically entered into by all three parties. Not only does the defendant fail to cite any authority for that proposition, he overlooks the provisions in the statute, SDCL 47-34A-103, which specifically states that the members of a limited liability company may enter into an operating agreement, which need not be in writing. All that is required to incorporate is that they file their articles of incorporation with the Secretary of State's office. If the Secretary of State's office finds that those articles conform to statute, he's required by statute to issue a certificate of incorporation. Under statute, that certificate is deemed conclusive evidence that the company has been duly and legally organized. In this particular case, Dakota Properties was issued a certificate of incorporation back on January 28, 2004. The other argument the state likely briefly touched on the other day is the defendant's argument that given his current age and life expectancy, a sentence imposed by the trial court amounted to a de facto life sentence. The defendant complains that under the sentence imposed, he would not be eligible for parole until he's 70 years old. It should be noted, however, that the defendant in his brief rather concedes, and I quote, in enacting SDCL 22-39-36, South Dakota's forgery statute with its 5-year maximum penalty and the enhancement statute permitting sentencing courts to elevate penalties by one level, the legislature was acting within its clear power, as was the trial court in imposing sentence.
Any idea why the judge gave him that sentence? That is a pretty long sentence for these offenses. Why did the judge do this?
I believe the trial court elected to impose the second sentence under statute based on the evidence that was presented at the sentencing hearing. The evidence presented at the sentencing hearing, after hearing the testimony, the trial court's remarks were along the lines of, it's quite obvious to the trial court that the defendant had a larcenous spirit to him. I believe he was described as someone who would prey on other people, would steal from anybody, in this particular case, including Dr. Smith, who despite his terminal illness made attempts to befriend and befriend it.
Did he have a felony record?
Yes. The defendant's criminal history spanned over 20 years and included multiple theft convictions. The trial court, based on the defendant's criminal history, indicated, I quote, the defendant does not have much of a conscience. The court was therefore reasonably satisfied that if he got out tomorrow, he'd probably be doing the exact same thing again.
There was total counts was he sentenced on? What did it end up being?
He was sentenced on one count of grand theft. The court consolidated 14 counts into one count and received 15 years. He was sentenced on 5 counts of forgery, 10 years as to each, and the court ran those consecutive for 50 years, plus the 15 on the grand theft, within a total of 65. It's the state's position that the sentence imposed was clearly within that authorized by statute. SDCL 22-6-6.1. Clearly authorizes a trial court to impose consecutive sentences regardless of when the offenses or crimes were committed.
Did he admit to the enhancement on it?
Yes, he admitted to the part two. Now, unless there are any further questions from the court, the state is going to propose to ask that the defense conviction be affirmed in all respects.
Mr. Doe, maybe to ask you the same question I asked defense counsel. Was there some evidence of money missing, and how much was missing?
There was evidence in the record that the money was missing, but I can't give you a specific dollar amount.
Okay.
What had happened is, okay, the money that the court of property to Dr. Smith was issuing checks to the defendant, the secretary of the court of properties, pay off the amounts listed in invoices to go to subcontractors, material suppliers. It was later determined that many of the subcontractors, as well as the suppliers, hadn't been paid. It was for that reason that Dr. Smith and Little made repeated attempts to sit down with the defendant and go through his checkbook to exactly find out where the money had gone. The defendant, however, refused to allow them access to
the money. So he was claiming that he had paid these people and that, in fact, they were not paid.
Right, exactly. Romano, subcontractor had not been paid, provided material means, material suppliers had not been paid. There were several credit accounts that had been opened in the name of the company using Dr. Smith and Little's identity and personal information that also made them. And one kind of loan, I believe, was at Lowe's. There's an unpaid balance of $25,000. There's evidence in the record, and I believe the trial court commented on it in sentencing, I think the reasonable inference is that the defendant was taking money and applying it toward his gambling debts. Comment that in the court's mind, there was no doubt that this is more than just a business venture. The defendant continued taking and stealing monies from the doctors just to support his gambling habits.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Mr. Adams, you have 10 minutes.
Thank you. I do want to respond to the issue about the length of the sentence. The court, in this case, gave the maximum sentence on every conviction that there was enhanced. Each one was enhanced. So that he ended up giving 15 years for the theft. He gave 10 years for the conspiracy. It was 10. And he ran those concurrent. He gave 5 years for the conspiracy, and he ran those concurrent. And then he gave 10 years on each of the forgeries, and only one of those ran concurrent. So he gave the maximum sentence on all of those issues. Mr. Geegan stated that my client's criminal history went back 20 years, which is true. He had prior felony convictions, but they were not recent matters. They were old matters out of the state of Texas. So why he received that maximum time, I don't know, and why what ultimately amounts to a life sentence.
They obviously weren't old enough, though, that they fell out of the whatever the year is for enhancement.
No, they were utilized.
How old was he at the time of sentencing?
At the time of sentencing, I believe he's in his early 50s.
Okay. Under this sentence, pardon?
I could be wrong. I don't think, now that I think about it,
we can all be wrong.
Yeah, I don't think he was that old.
All right. And when would he be eligible for parole under that sentence?
26 years when he's age 70 is what we calculated.
Yeah. Like the life expectancy.
Not make him in his 50s. He'd be younger than that.
We'll do the math.
Yes.
All right. Never mind.
But, you know, this court has stated, you know, grossly disproportionate to the crime is the standard that you look at. I read all of the cases reference that, and they all deal with people that are involved in rapes and sexual contacts, murders, crimes that are significant and injure somebody. They're not property crimes. This is a property crime, and I think the fact that, you know, what amounts to a life sentence for a property crime is what brings this into the category of being grossly disproportionate.
Have we ever discussed that as an element that we look at when determining gross disproportionality, whether it's property versus a personal crime against a person?
The cases have only addressed it by virtue of the fact that they talk about the legislature and how they set penalties for the crimes. In this particular case, all of these forgeries, and I didn't get to talk about that, but instead of being one forgery, as the Johnston case held, and what our circuit court held with regards to the thefts, all of the forgeries he considered to be individual and separate, and so he stacked those all on top. But if we start with that proposition that the legislature classifies these crimes as to how severe they are, this is way down the list. It's a Class 5 felony. Both Bonner and Hinger talked about the fact that the legislature, and in recent years particularly, have been increasing the penalties, particularly for those sexual crimes. And that's what all of the reviews came under and looked at those. Some were turned around and some were not. But grossly disproportionate when you're talking with a property crime and a life sentence, I think, is clear. And in addition to that, the court never addressed directly the issue of rehabilitation. And in addition to not considering proportionality, He never considered the issue of rehabilitation and whether Mr. Gard would be a candidate for rehabilitation. So in that regard also, I think the sentencing is grossly disproportionate. Needs to be at least reviewed again by the circuit
court. So you don't think that the judge's comments about if I turn you loose, you'll just do this again, fits under rehabilitation analysis?
He touched on it, but he never really dealt with that issue. And I think if you're going to impose a life sentence on somebody, you need to do more than just touch on it.
Thank you, Mr. Adams. Court will be in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning. Once again, we have these publications available in the lobby, and feel inclined to help yourself on the way up. We're in recess.